Hey, this is Barney Rubble, and you're listening to the, hey, Fred, what podcast are we listening to? Barn, the Movie Rob Minute Podcast. Oh, that's right. Keep on listening.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 87 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action movie Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me again today is Aaron Neuwirth of Out Now with Aaron and Abe. Welcome back to the show, Aaron.
Come out to the podcast, have a good time, hear some laughs.
Just stay away from the new Provo front. They might get you in a little bit of trouble. Mm-hmm. Who knows?
You know, I've actually been to Nakatomi Tower a few times.
Oh, wow. Cool.
By the way. Yeah. Like, there's, it's Fox. It's Fox Studios.
And did, so did you have to take off your shoes?
Not the time that I went there, but like the towers, like you drive, you can't miss it. Like, if you know what you're looking at, like, so you're like, when you're driving to Fox Studios for screenings, it's right there, which is just neat. But I've been in, I've also in the screening, you know, the studio's next to it, but I've been in the building as well when they had a, there is a 4K Blu-ray presentation for Deadpool, and it was
Wow.
I got to go into the Nakatomi Tower and get right in the elevator up to a floor where we had a special screening room where it was like a two monitors, and one was like a Blu-ray and one was a 4K, and you had director Tim Miller of Deadpool there, and some 4K experts like going over like the differences that are offered between the two. But I'm like, I'm sitting in Nakatomi Tower, you know, the Fox business building, doing this. Like, this is neat.
So you weren't really paying attention to what they're talking about, but Deadpool.
I was paying plenty of attention, but like going into like the lobby of the building is like, this is it. This is the building. This is great.
And did it look the same?
I mean, aesthetically, it looks the same. I mean, it's a little different as far as the basic decor or what have you, but in terms of like the layout, it's like, yeah, all right, this adds up.
You think that they filmed a lot of the, like, in the lobby, that is the lobby itself, or was that a soundstage?
Like, the geography of it made, I mean, I'm sure it was a soundstage as far as them actually doing stuff, but in terms of what it looks like, it's like, this looks like the lobby.
Oh, wow. Very cool. And did you park there?
There's a parking garage.
No, I know there's a parking garage because Argyle's there. I'm just wondering. Yeah.
It's not an underground parking garage. No, I didn't park in that one. Oh, I know it exists, but I did not park in it.
And did they let you go up to the roof?
Not to the roof, no. But it wasn't under construction anymore either on the other floors.
So oh, okay. And I'm assuming they've had hundreds, if not thousands, of people come into their office and say, oh, this is where they did Die Hard.
I'm sure they use that specifically for like a lot of meetings, like those specific offices.
Yeah, and here you can see the bloodstains from
Leave it there. It's on one of the chairs. The window.
Exactly. Here's where Ellis was shot, and here's where Takagi was shot. And if you walk down this corridor, you can see where Carl got strangled by the by the chains.
They just have a body hanging. It's a stunt man who comes alive every now and then. Scare people.
Hey, why not? That sounds like fun. Very cool. All right, so episode 87 begins with Al continuing to defend John and ends with Hans continuing with his demands. Mm-hmm. So yesterday we ended things with Robinson saying that he, he's very disappointed in John, and Al, stood up for John, trying to defend him. And he ended the minute yesterday by saying, why don't you wake up? And today we get the end of that sentence where he says, and smell what you're shoveling. And Robinson just, first of all, I brought it up a little bit yesterday, but it's pretty bold of Al to talk this way to his superior. He could get easily reprimanded or fired or whatever it is, for talking. I mean, again, we both are in agreement, and most people are in agreement, that Robinson's an idiot and, whatever. But just because your boss is an idiot doesn't necessarily mean that you can badmouth him, in front of others.
Yeah, but I mean, for one thing, it's a movie, but also it's
what? No, it's not.
It's extreme it's extreme circumstances. Like I and I think the line that's coming is what this all works up to. Like as far as his dedication to all of this, and I think that makes it entirely worth it to him as a character.
Right. And then Robinson says to him, "You listen to me, Sergeant. Anytime you want to go home, you consider yourself dismissed." And then Al responds by saying, "No, sir. You couldn't drag me away."
Which just rules. Like, it is such a great line. And that's like the everything he says leading up to that. It like, this is just the great culmination point of who Al is as a person right now. Like, who is this man? He's not a guy that, you know, he's introduced buying Twinkies. He's then, you know, seen being skeptical of a situation that he's been dragged to that he didn't want to go to. And now he's here being like, "I'm in it till the end because this guy is doing the best he can. And the only thing I can do is be down here and stand up for him because I see what's going on here. I am reading between the lines." Right. And I entirely respect it. Like, it's if there's a way to put down this man who is a superior, yes, I understand that. That's the way to do it, to show that I am here to do my job. When do you start doing yours? That's what he's telling him.
More or less. That's very true. Now, I mean, makes me wonder why Robinson just doesn't say, you know, "Get out of here. You're dismissed." You know, he just tells him that if you don't want to be here, you don't have to be here. So
because he knows he's right. He knows it's like, you know what? I did just kind of jump to conclusions as to this guy dying, and like I'm being made a fool of by Al.
No, I don't think so. I think Robinson understands that
he knows that he's wrong.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I gotta disagree with you on that one there.
I think he's too bullheaded to admit that he's not in the best of shape to handle this.
I think he's too bullheaded to believe that he's, you know, that he's wrong here. Because again, we're going to see later this week with the FBI guys and stuff like that. He continues to act as if, you know, he's in charge and knows everything that's going on.
He wants to believe that. I think deep down he knows the truth, that he has no power in this, that he's completely out of his element.
Okay, that's an interesting way of looking at it. But I have trouble believing that Robinson is that smart to realize that he made that he's making mistakes. He's like Ellis.
I don't think he thinks he's doing
the right thing.
But I also think I would argue that Ellis eventually realizes that he is also completely out of his depth.
As a bullet is going through his brain, yes.
Yeah. Well, even the last look on his face, I think he understands when he's asking for John to say anything and John's not saying anything. We're back to Ellis talk again. I do think in the span of a few seconds where there is a gun pointed at him, he's understanding I was wrong. Like, this is not the way I should have handled this. Whether my cocaine powers did not, you know, work for me or not, I'm not right here. Like, I've stepped completely out of my zone. I can't talk my way out of it. What does he say? Like, I eat like you're trash for lunch or something like that. Like, before he steps in to try to.
No, that's what he said beforehand. Yeah.
Before he steps in to handle.
Yeah.
I do think these are the.
I make million-dollar decisions for breakfast.
That is, there it is. Yeah, I think these guys that think
million-dollar deals. Sorry.
There you go. I think these guys that think that him and Dwayne that think they have things under control just because they are in a position that makes them think they can be, I don't think that necessarily denotes the idea that they're completely convinced of that. There's not enough on Dwayne to like go further into because he's just a complete screenwriter character as far as always has to be wrong despite being in control. That's the kid. It's a two-dimensional character. But I do think just being told off by Al. Deep down, I think he recognizes that, like, there are different ways he could handle things. He's not going to. He's not going to make that decision. But, like, he knows.
Right. Okay, I hear what you're saying, but I still think that he's too much of an idiot to realize that, you know, for him, his way is the right way. It doesn't matter what everyone else wants to do. You know?
It's sort of like expressing that. Yes, I agree.
Yeah. Right, but I don't think he thinks in his mind that someone else's idea is better or that he's wrong.
I don't think he's thinking deeply about it, but I do think it's there. I do think there's a part of him that understands something is amiss as far as his logic and what's actually happening.
Okay, All right, that's fair. And then we hear talk come over the CB. We hear Hans, attention police, attention police. And immediately Al grabs the walkie-talkie. He goes, "This is Sergeant Al Powell." And then Robinson looks at him and goes, "Give me that." This is Deputy Chief Dwayne Robinson. Who is this? This is Hans Gruber. I assume you realize the futility of direct action against me. We have no wish for further loss of life. Well, what is it that you do wish for, Mr. Gruber? I have comrades in arms around the world, languishing in prison. The American State Department enjoys rattling its saber for its own ends. Now it can rattle it for me. The following people are to be released from their captors. In Northern Ireland, the 7 members of the New Provo Front. In Canada, the 5 imprisoned leaders of Liberté de Québec. In Sri Lanka, the 9. And then that's where the dialogue gets cut off here with this minute. Now, first of all, I love the fact that while he's talking, we see all these things going on behind him. You know, well, first of all, I mean, we have the first question that I asked, let's move back a little bit, is that why does Al take the CB and think that he's the one who should be doing the negotiations at this point?
He just told off his boss. He's feeling a little heightened in that moment, I believe. And also the walkie-talkie is just right in front of him.
So right. Okay.
He's grabbed it. I mean, it's a mix of practicality and self-esteem.
Right. Okay. And I mean, it's just funny that then Robinson says, "Give me that." You know, it's somewhat of a slapstick type of line for him to say it that way. And then like he grabs it from his head.
He's a silly character. That's his design, to be silly in every scene.
Yeah. Completely. And then when Robinson takes the thing, he begins to stutter a little bit. Which is again trying to show us that he really is weighing over his head here. Yeah. You know, he's not a negotiator.
No.
You know, he doesn't even know how to say his own name. He's stuttering by saying his own name. And I mean, I like the fact that Hans at this point is willing to tell everyone that it is him. You know, we heard earlier that there was a, you know, suspicion that Hans Gruber is the person that we're talking about here. Right. But it's never been proven completely until this point when he actually says, you know, that this is Hans Gruber. You know, obviously we understand this because that's part of his plan. If they don't know that it's Hans Gruber, then, you know, once he's quote unquote dead, people won't be looking for Hans Gruber anymore.
Yeah. It's a mix of planning and also just pride.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if that was part of his plan at this point to reveal it. You know, whether it would have been on the news or not.
I believe so. I mean, it's a I mean, presumably, if nothing happened with... Well, no, because he had planned for the FBI to come the whole time. So, like, there was some.
He planned for the FBI, but he hasn't gotten to the point where the FBI is there yet. You know,
no, but like, I mean, at some point, he was going to have to like present this kind of information. Like, it wasn't like the plan was always going to be this stealthy thing where nobody knew about it. Like, the plan was always to involve the authorities to some degree.
Right. I mean, there's also the whole idea that when his, you know, when they mention on the news that it might be Hans Gruber, they say just, you know, an hour ago, the, you know, the group that he works for, you know, issued a statement saying that they no longer have ties with him. Mm-hmm. Meaning, so that is all part of his plans, you know, that they are everyone, you know, everyone's going to be looking for Hans and, you know, you don't look for a dead man. So there's no need for
that. I guess if Takagi gave up everything right away, then there I guess this is like the plan that they probably knew they were going to have to do. But like maybe things go the right way and he just gives up the combination and they're in and they don't have to do any of that.
Wow. But, you know what? I never even thought about that. That would have been great. You know, he's like, give me the code. Okay.
He gets there you go. And then they get everything they want and they get away. So this is like, I wouldn't say this is the backup plan because I assume that he's like, this is what we're probably going to have to do. Maybe it goes the easy way and Takagi gives us everything right away. Probably not going to happen. So right. We're going to have to do this and get the FBI involved so we can break everything down. Like, so that's, but I mean, in terms of your original question, is it like at this point in the night, would this have been what he planned to do? I don't know. It depends on what his goal was. If McClane wasn't involved, right? Presumably right. he'd have to like, I don't know if he just like ring the cops and be like, hey, guess what? I'm taking over this building. You got to give me this stuff. Or if he like, since he had the detonators, I mean, he's always going to blow the roof up.
Right.
But he had like, I mean, he has anti-tank weapons and everything. Like he was going to do something to set off the alarm, essentially, to get the cops to get there to begin with. Like that had to be a part of the plan. Because right. he needed to have the police presence to create chaos.
Right. And again, for him to, you know, for everyone to assume that he's dead, you know, they have to know that he's there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, what part of the night this is supposed to happen? I don't know. Who's to say? But like, is in terms of like, was he always going to do this? Yes.
It's funny the fact that he says that, you know, he doesn't want any further loss of life, which his whole plan is lots of loss of life. Let's continue with the facade. Let's see how gullible the police are. You know, we want peace.
Means to an end. Yeah.
Exactly. Completely. And, you know, as he's talking, you know, we see a shot of the room, which it pans through the room, and we see, you know, Ellis's head, and we see, you know, blood and brains oozing out of it onto the chair. You know, to once again show us, you know, the irony of someone who says we don't want any further loss of life, but I just, you know, a few minutes ago just blew someone's brains out. So nice contrast. Yeah.
I mean, this is just talking about, you know, what McTiernan's doing as a director. And speed director Jean DeBont as a cinematographer. It's just good craft. Like as far as
for sure.
Juxtaposing this stuff, it works.
Yeah, completely. And then he starts talking about these various different terrorist groups. You know, he mentions the new Provo Front. Okay, which obviously anyone will try and do a search, you will not find it because there's no such thing. It's supposedly based on the real organization of the Provisional Irish Republican Army. Yeah, so they just found a nice way to not offend by, you know, changing the name a little bit. Changing the names to protect the innocent.
I mean, I assume that's the case for all these things. They're all, like, yes. Rooted in some kind of truth. And then you can say the same about this other thing later as far as a certain syndrome. But
right, there. Exactly. So you have the Liberté de Québec. Which obviously also is not real. And then we have the Liberté de Québec is based on a real life organization known as the Front de Libération du Québec, the FLQ, which is a militant Quebec separatist group that in 1970, kidnapped two government officials. They accidentally killed one of them and started what's known as the October Crisis, which was the only time that Canada ever invoked martial law during peacetime.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we have Sri Lanka, which we're going to have to wait until tomorrow to find out the name of that terrorist organization. But what do you know about the country of Sri Lanka?
It's a tiny little island off of the southern tip of India. It, I believe, has had to go through a number of violent political struggles to maintain.
Yes, that's to say the least. They've had numerous assassinations of their leaders.
Yeah, there's a film that I believe won the Palme d'Or, early 2010s, called Deepan. That's very much it's about a Sri Lankan man who has to go to he has to move his family to India after like getting out of one of the wars that occurred there. It's a good movie. But yeah, no, I mean I'm quite aware of Sri Lanka as a nation.
Yes. So do you know what year it became a nation? When it got its independence?
I want to. Is it it like 50s, 60s? Is it earlier than that?
48. 1948.
40, okay, 50s. Okay, good.
Yeah, you're close. You're close. Yeah. Close. Good. I mean, obviously, their history goes back like 3,000 years, but I'm talking about
exactly, since yeah, in terms of like, yeah.
Yeah, that, I mean, they had a 26-year civil war, which began in 1983 and went until 2009.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know, it's a very small country that is that has had many problems over its almost 75 years of existence. Yeah. And I mean, it was part of the British conquest. Mm-hmm. You know, the Brits colonized it in 1815 until they gave it its independence in 1948. Well, but as we said, there've been a lot of political turmoil over those years. You know, I mean, even one of the prime ministers who was assassinated, his wife became the new prime minister, and then they tried assassinating her. And there was an attempted coup, and you know, fun.
Yeah,
as they say.
Well, at least you live in a place that has no political turmoil whatsoever.
No, and you also. I don't know which I don't know whether Israel or America is a safer place to want to live these days. we're all in the as they say.
See what you're shoveling.
That's right. There you go. Very good. The thing that I like about the way that Hans is making up all of these this you know the fact that he wants these people released is he's basically saying to everybody, I'm a political terrorist.
Yeah.
He's throwing it out there in order to confuse them even more, so that later on nobody will say, oh, well, you know, all this money is missing, so, you know, it must have been them, but they're political terrorists. They must have some sort of political gain that they're trying to get here. You know, it completely is there to, throw the, what's it called? What's the phrase? Throw the monkey wrench? Throw the...
A wrench into the gears?
Okay, there you go. That's good, too. There's another phrase that I'm trying to think of right now that I can't really think of. But, you know, something like that. All right. Did you have anything else for this minute before we get into the script?
No, nothing else in my scenario.
Okay. So, again, the script has a few minor discrepancies. In the final cut, Al says, and smell what you're shoveling. In the script, it says, and smell the... you're shoveling. Okay. Again, six of one half of a dozen of the other, it's the same thing. Doesn't really make much of a difference.
Because he took out a fuck last week in the script there also. I mean, it just feels like, you know, the choice being made is like, you know, I'm mouthing off to my superior. I can do that without resorting to a certain level of profanity, I guess is the...
Or maybe it was because he knew that he was going to be on like a sitcom, you know, and needed to start cleaning up his language a little bit.
It's here nor there. I know what you're saying, but I mean, I can see like you know a cop trying to know his place while still trying to make a point. I think he's smart enough to know how to do that without you know getting nasty with the language. I guess.
Right. Okay. That's true. And then after Hans begins to talk and says "intention police" twice, so then the script says it's asses and elbows time. Tape recorders are started. Which makes no sense whatsoever. You know, have you ever heard that term before? Asses and elbows time?
I have.
And what does it mean? I mean, I didn't look it up. I'm wondering what it means.
I don't know how to use that in the right context, honestly.
In this movie or in general?
In general. I don't know a way where I'm like, I should use asses and elbows. It's like a way to further along the point that I'm trying to make.
Yeah. So the only thing that the only other difference here is we get a shot of McLean listening in as they're listening to all of to everything being said here, and it basically you know he's got this like strange look on his face like what the hell is he talking about, And then it says, listen to this with expressions ranging from astonishment to dismay to outright derisive amusement. That makes me laugh that they say that's the way John is listening to the whole thing. You know, he's just sitting there, you know, smoking a cigarette while he's listening to it. He's not giving many facial expressions here with the way that he's doing that. But, yeah. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition, where my guest will give a little story about some sort of adventure or misadventure or trip of something that happened around the holidays. So what have you got for us, Aaron?
I want to say this is 2006 or 2007. I was in college at UC Santa Barbara in California, and it was going to be Hanukkah. And it was... It's post Thanksgiving, which makes sense, but sometimes it's early. But like before, like holidays, so I'm still at college as opposed to like back at home for like winter break or whatever. And because it was going to be Hanukkah and I'm away from home, you know, the days would be ostensibly spent in my door in my apartment at that time. I needed to find a menorah because I didn't have one my own. I didn't. You know, my dad had. Menorah. So I spent a good like Saturday just hunting all over the area to find a menorah. It was increasingly difficult and frustrating because I went to all these different stores, you know, like greeting card stores and like Target and like things like that, you know, places where you could hopefully find, you know, anything. and it,
apparently not Thanksgiving time.
Not Thanksgiving, yeah. So it took me a good long day to. I went to so many different places in like I'm in Santa Barbara. The college is technically outside of Santa Barbara, but I went downtown to Santa Barbara to like go to different stores to see if they had anything. Got back to Goleta, the city that's next to Santa Barbara, which is where like the school is. Went to more stores. Eventually, finally found a Hallmark store. And it was like it was night at that point, and it's you know November or whatever, so early December, so it, you know it's like 6-7 o'clock or whatever. Found a Hallmark store that was like almost closing, and I got in there and I asked like, "Do you have any menorahs?" It's like, "We do, we have a menorah." And I found a menorah. I got candles. I still have that menorah to this day. It's a silver menorah that I do not. I mean, it's a podcast. I don't need to show you the menorah. It's not accessible to me at this time anyway. But I still have it, and I use it when I go traveling or if I know I'm going to be away from, like, you know, family in my own home to, you know, celebrate Hanukkah the way I generally do. But it was quite the journey to find a menorah for myself.
Well, that's really cool, though, because especially, you know, you have this, you know, this item that now has, you know, traveled with you for 15 years.
Yeah,
so that's really cool. You know, and it always will remind you of your college days, or that particular day. You know, searching over the entire city for a menorah. Yeah, that's actually a good script. You should do something like that.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea.
You know, there aren't that many Hanukkah stories, so why not?
No, they're not. They're not. It's always always wondering like, where are the Hanukkah story? Where are the Hanukkah movies coming out?
There you go. So now Aaron will have one. Yeah. You know?
Yep.
Start working on that script.
We're chopping it. Yeah.
Just as long as you smell what you're shoveling.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll get Reginald Bell Johnson involved. It'll be great.
Hey, why not? Maybe he'll be interested.
He can't be that expensive. Not today.
It's probably true. That's unfortunately very true. All right. So, Aaron, you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah. Everything I do ends up on my personal blog, thecodeofzeke.com, but I host a podcast called Out Now with Aaron and Abe. With my friend Abe, we talk about weekly movie releases. I write for leagueofentertainment.com for movie reviews and wiseofblue.com for Blu-ray and Criterion reviews. And I'm on Twitter at Aaron's PS4.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. And you can find me on my website. So, Aaron, you feel like coming back again tomorrow?
Yeah, sure.
All right, very good. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.